came to Iran, and also the foreign minister, the non-allied ministerial committee, consisting of four foreign ministers, headed by Malmyerka of Cuba, and the political officer of PLO, and Zambia and India. We get together with Rafsanjani, was always there, Khamenei was always the Beheshti, never attended. He was extremely clever. He was always tried to be above these kind of contacts as head of the judiciary, where he managed to gain real power over the institutions of the society. These sessions, and I sit with Banisadr and his advisor, these sessions were like almost student movement. They present, generally speaking, they want to establish a ceasefire, because Iraq wants a ceasefire in place followed by negotiation, which means de facto acknowledgement of occupation of Iran by Iran that nobody wanted in Iran. We say withdrawal and ceasefire and withdrawal simultaneously. These meetings were kind of revealing with respect to some, anecdotal, behavioral, off-the-cuff remarks coming from various leaders, but they didn't really produce anything substantive with respect to resolving the conflict. One important, interesting kind of development was when the Islamic Peace Conference came, exactly at 12 o'clock, Ziaul-Haq interrupted the meeting and said, "It's time for prayer." And this suggestion coming from Ziaul-Haq was extremely embarrassing to the clerical elements who were sitting. Another very interesting thing, that Ahmad Khomeini was attending these meetings as representative of his father. The first time we went to the meeting, it was in the headquarters, the center of Khiyabon Shemrune Sabe. Ahmad Khomeini entered the room. It was like 5 minutes before the meeting was to start. He asked an officer, he said, "Where is my place?" And before waiting for answer, he said, "I want to sit next to Aghai Banisadr." He said, "Well, next to Aghai Banisadr, Aghai Farhang is sitting because they have to talk to each other if there is any kind of debate and all that." And then he said, "I don't want to sit next to Ahunda." That's It was incredible. I mean, it was such a revealing moment that for him, initially, he wanted to associate himself, Ahmad, with the secular religious type of people and not with the Muslims. One specific thing that he said, which was really mind-blowing to me, he said, "I don't want to sit next to Sheikh Ali Akbar," which meant Rafsanjani. So he managed. Banisadr was sitting here. I was sitting next to him. Ahmad was sitting next to me, and next to him was Fakhruddin. He was a colonel and minister of defense. So he, for the entire week, about 4 or 5 sessions altogether we had with all this, as with this thing, he made absolutely certain that he sits between between me and Fakhruddin. And initially Fakhruddin and I were supposed to sit together. There was nothing ever to be discussed with regard, but if there was negotiation, obviously we were going to consult politically and militarily and all that. It was logical that we should be good. But since there was no such a thing, this was my plan. And then this, when Ziaul-Haq interrupted the meeting, so So they were very upset. Next day, they had not done this the first day. The next day, when the meeting opened up, Khamenei said, before we begin the meeting, I would like to ask Aghai Parvaresh, who was a member of parliament from Isfahan, and he was one of the two people representing Majlis in the negotiating session. Rafsanjani was the speaker, so he was automatically the two other members besides Rafsanjani. Muhammad Montazeri and Parvaresh. They were selected by Majlis to participate in this session. Just a couple of sessions, and then two of them changed later on. So they said, well, he should begin with reciting the Quran, a verse of Quran, which was obviously a retaliation to counter Ziya ul-Haq's embarrassing remark that this is time for prayer. So once they met with Khomeini, and Khomeini was dismissal of all these people. When they returned, they came back twice. They were really involved in heavy negotiations that Saddam absolutely refused to submit to their suggestion. When they returned, they again wanted to see Khomeini. And at this time, being with Khomeini was useful to all of them politically back home. Khomeini at this time really was a giant in the Islamic world. I think he remains a giant for significant sectors of people in the Islamic world. But this time, really, very prestigious for them to be seen by him. And Khomeini, the second time, said, no, I don't want to see these people anymore. So they sent Yasser Arafat, which was really mind-boggling, that why do they have to go through so much trouble just to be seen with Khomeini? So they sent Yasser Arafat a day earlier to arrange another meeting with Khomeini. And they came to Bani Sa'd, and Arafat said, if we are not going to see, it was his idea, if we are not going to meet with Imam and have a discussion with him, how about if we go to the mosque where he prays and pray behind him? Which was mind-blowing. The idea was kind of appealing to Bani Sa'd. So Bani Sa'd immediately picked up the phone and called Ahmad. In those days they were very, close. And in fact, whether it was his way of gaining Bani Sa'd's confidence and knowing what he was thinking. In those days, they used to think that Bani Sa'd as an organization, as a strategy, which was absolutely false and preposterous. He had absolutely nothing. Or he felt genuinely a sense of affinity with him. So he called Ahmad. Ahmad came over, and they talked about the idea, and Khomeini was persuaded. They all went there, and he came. Look, they were all there. Khomeini walked in, stood before them. He was the Friday. He was the prayer leader. They all prayed, and the cameras and all that were under covering this event. The Prime Minister of Turkey, I don't think he had ever prayed in his life. And it was so obvious that he didn't know exactly her movements, and all that. And without saying a word, he came and did his thing and left. That was the extent. Another interesting event, that Olaf Palme was the only one with a genuine commitment to a resolution of the conflict. He was appointed by the UN. And the person who accompanied him, Iqbal Reza, the Pakistani diplomat, seasoned and very intelligent. They worked very hard, and they came up with some very fascinating and interesting kind of proposals. And apparently, initially, they managed to get some inclination from Saddam Hussein that he would accept simultaneous ceasefire and withdrawal. And when the idea was presented to us as feasible, realistic, and all that, then Olaf Palme said, but simultaneous ceasefire and withdrawal is not technically possible, because if there is ceasefire, it takes some time. They had come into Iranian territory along a stretch of about 500 kilometers anywhere from 5 to 70 kilometers in. It takes time for them to return. And Banisat could not answer this directly. He said, let me talk with Imam and all that. So he went to see Khomeini and he presented this idea. And Khomeini said, first of all, he's responsible that as good Muslims, we will not shoot retreating soldiers. So if they need some time to evacuate and to withdraw, we will give them the necessary time. But that has to be informal, that we cannot recognize that as part of an agreement that they have 2 weeks about. And then he went on to telling them, he said, an anecdote, which immediately, I went home and wrote it down instantly and again used it in an article because I thought it was again very interesting with respect to Khomeini's thinking. Banisadr Khomeini listened to this situation, this withdrawal and the time. He said there was a man who entered the village. It was in the middle of the night when it was very cold. He knocked on the door and asked the owner of the house, who opened the door, for a place to sleep. And the man said, the host said, you know, welcome. And when they went to, showed him the room, said, here is your room, but I apologize to you, I don't have a blanket to give you, and it's a very cold night, but I'm ashamed to mention it, but I do have a paloon to give you if you wish to use that to protect yourself against the cold. And the man got very angry and said, no, no, I sleep in the cold. I prefer to sleep in the cold. I don't want, you know, the paloon. The host left the room. The guest couldn't go to sleep because it was so cold. After a few minutes, he got up and he called on the host and said, please bring that thing, but don't mention its name. And then he said, you go ahead and accept simultaneous ceasefire and withdrawal and give him some time to withdraw, but don't mention, you know, the name. You know. We were very hopeful for a couple of days. And they went to Baghdad. For some reason, it died, the idea died. Saddam refused to accept it. He wanted the stationing of his troops there, even if he was willing to withdraw. He wanted to drag it on and make a point that I'm able to occupy Iranian, you know, territory. But what happened, you know, the erratic nature of his response to all this situation. But anyway, that effort also was a complete failure and disappointment. It went on until March, and I went to Europe in January and February of 1980 and contacted all kinds of people in the French government, in particularly the new socialist government in France, that they were coming to power and all that, in Germany, in Austria. One person who was ambassador in Tehran really initiated many of these contacts was Chancellor of Germany, who died recently, Kreisky. He was really genuinely helpful in, he apparently had some contact also with Iraq. He got very involved with the Germans and the French through the International Socialist, you know, conference and all that. That effort failed. Saddam absolutely refused to budge. Banisadr the number of, on the part of Iran in late 1980 and early 1981, Iran made very desperate and serious attempts to settle the conflict. And the reason that it didn't even come close to being successful, that the United States was categorically indifferent or opposed to it. Great Britain was indifferent and opposed to it. The Soviet Union was completely indifferent and opposed to it. They were using, you know, the major powers saw the conflict as an instrument of their own foreign policy. And I was absolutely convinced that we are not going to get not only any help from this, and this is exactly what Olaf Palme finally told me when he withdrew from the situation. There isn't much reason right now. Either Saddam and Ayatollah Khomeini have to come to realize that they're just destroying their own resources and they make peace, or there has to be serious international pressure on Saddam Hussein to withdraw. So the international pressure is not there. In fact, there is effort to perpetuate it and prolong it. And Saddam is not a man to be convinced, so long as he can get international assistance to humiliate Iran and remain in Iran for his own aggrandizement and delusion of grandeur and so forth. So these were the conclusions that he reached, and they were very accurate. They were really accurate.
When you were negotiating, did the Iranian team decide among themselves what position they were going to take, or the various representatives?
The Iranian position was very clear. It was very straightforward and simple. We wanted the Iraqi troops to withdraw. We were incapable of Fallahi, Fakhouri, Zahir Nishat, who were the Iranian military chiefs. The information that they were unanimous and categoric that we cannot expel the Iraqis militarily now. And all were hopeful that gradually we can. But right now we cannot. They were right in gradually we can, but to the point that Khomeini forced them to take offensive action, then everything was reversed. So that was the military input, that if you could secure a negotiated settlement of Iraqi withdrawal, that is to our advantage. And that's what Bani said, and there was no... When it came to details of some conflicts and difficulties they had with respect to border, the 1975 treaty, or what is to be done and all that, there were some people in the State Department from the previous regime who knew much more about these things than we ever did. I started studying the documents and all that, but there were some really competent experts in the foreign ministry, but we never got to that point. The first thing was Saddam's agreement with the suggestion of withdrawal, which he never did.
Maybe that's a good time to go back to the non-aligned conference that you went to.
Non-aligned conference, yes. When we decided to go to Cuba, I started studying, the agenda of the Iranian delegation and the various meetings that had already been arranged. And one meeting was with the Iraqi delegation. And Saddam was going to be the all heads of the states. So we discussed it among ourselves, and it was very clear that the Iraqis are going to ask us about the 1975 treaty. Iraq had not yet renounced the treaty. They were testing the Iranian resolve with respect to renegotiating, whether or not Iran was open to the idea of renegotiating the treaty. But it was all informal, and at this time Khomeini was paying absolutely no attention to formal diplomacy. And the people in charge didn't know any of that stuff. And Khomeini's agenda about Iraq was helping through his own representatives he had and supporters, helping the Shi'i movements against Saddam Hussein, and also because Saddam had executed Ayatollah Saad. He was so completely adamant and opposed to Saddam that the notion of negotiation did not enter his agenda. So Yazdi finally decided that when we went to say goodbye to Khomeini, in August. That was the first time that I actually saw Khomeini, except that we didn't reintroduce us and all that. We didn't have any kind of conversation. We went to Qom. And Yazdi and Khomeini went to the back room. And the question Yazdi put to Khomeini at the time said, we are going to Cuba. And this, we had discussed it in Yazdi's office in foreign ministry, in details actually. He said, we are going to Cuba, and the Iraqis are going to ask us about our view the 1971 treaty, what should we say? Do we accept it? Because in principle, this is an agreement that serves our interests. And everybody was convinced of that, that we definitely want to preserve this agreement and confer Iran's commitment to its provisions. Khomeini's response again was very classic, was don't say yes, don't say no. Navigate, vale, navigate now. So when Yazidi told me this, I said, boy, he said, a treaty signed by Saddam Hussein and the Shah, to whom he hated most, would be unacceptable to him. So we were very indecisive. And we had a meeting with Saddam Hussein for about 2 hours, which was, you know, another story. They couldn't get, we didn't have a position. We simply did not have in a position, which was kind of embarrassing and stupid. They were not particularly too anxious to push us either, because they were bluffing, you know. But yet they were undoubtedly interested in negotiating, in contacting, in having cordial relationship with Iran. I cannot deny that, that Saddam Hussein reiterated over and over his desire to have normal and friendly relations with Iran. And for his own political purposes at the time, the Iranian revolution was immensely and intensely popular in Iraq. He did not want to have a confrontational position with Iran. And yet he wasn't afraid either. He didn't particularly seem alarmed. He was very thuggish and yet conciliative. A realist and yet a high-risk gambler and all that, as he has always been. And we did not respond, and the general kind of consensus and impression was that negotiations and an understanding between the two countries will kind of gradually emerge as the Iranian, it was in the midst of still matters at Khebregan and the people kind of, as they use these issues to say that the reason about slowness or indecisiveness of Iran has to do with absence of institutionalizations and power is not sufficiently consolidated, and so on. And in the middle of a conversation, it was in one moment, Yazdi said, we overthrew a 2,500-year monarchy as in the way of bragging about it. And Saddam Hussein interrupted him and said, he had two interpreters. He said, it took you a long time. So that was the end. But remember, after all this, what Khomeini said to Yazdi, this is September 1st or 2nd, 1979, exactly a year later, when Iraq is invaded Iran. 10 days after that invasion, Khomeini's son-in-law, Gurujerdi, was the cultural advisor to the foreign ministry. Khomeini personally ordered him to issue a statement on behalf of the foreign ministry about the 1975 treaty, after Iraq declared a unilateral rejection and dissolution of the treaty. Then the foreign ministry, with the direct order of Khomeini, took the opposite position, and the 1975 treaty is valid. We accept it as a solid international treaty, and we both sides have to live by its provisions, and so on. While a year earlier, he had said, don't say yes, don't say no and all that. So his change of position was a response to a pragmatic necessity.
Okay, so that was, I think, the war negotiations failed.
And not only that failed, but by this time, by March 1981, Banisadr had become completely powerless. He wanted to send two people. North Korea invited Banisadr to go there for the anniversary of the revolution and all that. He didn't want to go, and he wanted to send a couple of people as his representative, but he was unable to obtain diplomatic passports for them because the foreign ministry says we only respond to the prime minister's a request or the minister. At that time, there was no foreign minister. Rajoy was actually the functioning foreign minister, and Banisadr refused to submit a request to Rajoy. So he didn't. He couldn't even hire a guard for his own house. People who were supposedly, theoretically, his guards, they were actually working for, with a couple, exception of a couple relatives who were probably protecting him for free, they were more in contact, they were under the order of Beheshti and his crowd. So during this period, it was the intense period of writing right before the shutdown of the newspaper, and speaking and making, you know, various conferences in Tehran. There was a place called Daftar-e Hamahangi Rais Jamhur, the Office for Coordination of Presidential Activities and so forth. We used this as, in fact, the headquarters of the opposition. And largely people who used to come there, they were academic, middle class, university, you know, type, because it was beginning to be really dangerous to be identified with opposition forces, with Banisadr. At the same time during this, you know, period, Mujahideen recognized the emptiness of Banisadr's presidency and absence of any organization in his apparatus. So they managed to penetrate the office of the president. There was one section of the office, the publicity section. How it happened, I don't know. But the Mujahideen managed literally to take over and put their own agents. There were other, Beheshti and his men had also managed to penetrate other parts of the office. They had their agents. And Banisadr had some individual friends from way back. He used to see regularly and discuss, you know, various matters without having any possibility of implementing anything. So Mujahideen at this time were extremely influential in radicalizing Banisadr's position. And here his vulnerability, his egoism was very susceptible to the kind of demonstrations and public support, which was largely artificial. Mujahideen were able to create, for example, when Banisadr is giving a lecture in Husseiniye Irshad or in any other place, they are so well organized that they pack the place in advance and they put their cadres in front and they have their slogans. And at the right moment, they begin to scream and shout their slogans. And they did it so systematically and so consistently that over a period of 2 or 3 months, Banisadr saw all this outpouring of support as general popular support, not knowing that it was a well-orchestrated act on the part of the Mujahideen. Mujahideen during this period saw Banisadr, and I'm saying these things retroactively. At the time, I could not, I know that they were active, but I had absolutely no idea that they were doing it with such a systematic strategy of building him up and using him in pursuit of his, of their own, you know, political, you know, agenda. And Banisadr fell into that trap, given the the fact that he had no organized support of his own, there was some general sentiment on his behalf, and some people saw hope in his presidency simply because they didn't find it anywhere else. Yeah. But when it came to organized political support, he had none, and Mujahideen filled that vacuum. In the process, they radicalized him, and they pushed him to take the kind of position that a rational political actor would not take, challenging Khomeini without having any possibility of backing it up. And when the day Banisadr was forced out of his office, his office was surrounded by revolutionary guards and demonstrators and Hezbollahis. When he managed to escape from the back door, he went to his own sister's. He had no place to go. And his sister's house was surrounded. These are the days that Majlis was discussing about the impeachment procedures. And Khomeini, still up to this moment, hoped that he would come and repent. Khomeini's strategy was to use Banisadr's prestige to the extent that he had it among certain sectors of Bazaris and middle class and all that against the Mujahideen.